There was a medical program in the area.
Uh-huh.
And AID had sent up plans to build a clinic. And it was they were very exotic plans. I mean, a building up on pillars, which was fine. But higher on pillars than any other building in town. Never quite figure out why you put an infirmary at the top of the highest stair step in town. That didn't always make sense to me, but that's what the plans called for. The buildings were on stilts, but maybe 3-5 feet off the ground, not 8 feet off the ground, and they were wooden. They were not concrete. So this was beyond the normal construction, if not maybe the capabilities of many of the people. And so AID ended up pretty much building this thing and giving it to the people. In the meantime, this is where AID was screwing up, because they didn't pay much attention to what was going on in the village.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons and a variety of personnel we won't get into. But the bottom line was that Ken and I, and Ken more than I, decided that we could wait forever for this building to be built. And so the local people built an infirmary.
On their own,
uh-huh. Waiting for this building. And then we had to, Ken and I, again, Ken was more the leader of this than I was. Ken had to persuade the AID people to allow them to move their medicines and their medical doctor,
mm-hmm.
Very loose medical doctor here, a little bit of first aid training, that was about it,
uh-huh.
But to let him work in that non-AID approved building. And there was a second building that had been put up earlier. It was kind of an outpost, and that was part of the original plan, that there was going to be this kind of main, I call it infirmary, it was a little clinic.
Yeah.
There was no place for people to stay. But, so they brought up these trained doctors, but the doctors would not stay out at that far village. So one of my responsibilities was every morning go to the doctor's house and drive him to that village, and every evening to bring him back.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were concerned that somebody, even as weak as his medical training was, where we were physically setting, that the Pathet Lao would not come in and kidnap him and then force him to be a medic for their soldiers.
Or shoot him. Yeah.
We had heard that there were landmines planted here and there.
Uh-huh.
And occasionally we heard of things blowing up, but nothing in our area.
Uh-huh.
But I remember one night being woken up about 2 in the morning, and some villager had come in. His wife was having, or at least some female family member, I don't know if it was his wife or not, was having problems,
yeah,
with childbirth. And the medical person refused to go out. Now this was, said we were here, the clinic was off in this direction, the Pathet Lao were up here. This was off kind of tangential to that, but he would not leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove him there in the middle of the night.
Oh, was it night? Yes.
Yeah, the middle of the night. He wouldn't go in the middle of the night. So I drove him there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the most risky thing I ever did, because there could have been a landmine there. There wasn't. There was never a landmine in the immediate area, but there were not too far away.
Yeah.
And
there were certainly Pathet Lao who could have been on patrol.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The only time that I ever encountered Pathet Lao, I'd have to get a, there's a huge man-made lake now in Laos, on the Nam Ngum River, I think it is. But at that time, that was put in after I left. They began to build it in the summer of 65 when I left. They're just moving in equipment. But at that time, that was just a kind of a lazy river. And we used to go up there, and if you laid down in the water just right, you could float for a half a mile. if you kept your butt up high, because otherwise you would scrape on the bottom of the stony river. But it was a nice relaxing, and it was water, and it was fairly clean.
Yeah.
But we were out there one time, and a patrol of Pathet Lao was patrolling along the shore, on the other side of the river, and we just kind of waved. that was the only encounter I had with Pathet Lao.
Did they wave back?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, they knew what was going on. They knew who we were, but you know, they fortunately they had no orders to do anything to us, and we only went up there two or three times. But that was one of those things. But as far as the military is concerned, that was the only.
Only
brush I had with them.
That is scary though.
Sitting here, it is at the moment. It didn't. You know, I was too naive or stupid to be scared, I guess.
Yeah.
But I spent a year in Phnom Penh, or in Phnom Hom.
Uh-huh.
And then was sent across the river to it'll come to me in a moment, but not real quickly, to another area. And I was the first one in there.
Uh-huh.
And we could travel. We had to take a ferry across the river, but we could get over there. And so in the early part of maybe late 64, early 65, I would go over there a couple times a week.
Uh-huh.
We got a house. We built a privy and this sort of thing prior to moving.
You say you weren't alone?
Well, my interpreter
was with
me.
Okay.
So we talked about Cambodian language. Laotian language, there was nothing ever formal. I was given an interpreter and I depended on him, and I never... In the year and a half I was there, I learned enough that I could go to a wedding celebration and kibitz for a few minutes in a social situation. They could quickly abandon me from their conversation anytime they wanted to.
Despite talking fast or complicated.
Yeah, they didn't have to talk fast or anything. they could lose me very quickly.
It's certainly understandable why. I mean,
yeah.
You were so changed around and had very little language training, even
and,
for
and very little language skills, quite frankly. I was not very good at it.
Even if you were a linguist, it would be difficult to catch up.
So we went over to this other area, got the house arranged, and then moved over. I said, it's been 10, 12 months, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Time.
Yeah.
Then went over to this other area. Name's still not coming to me.
You must have been there only for about 6 months or so.
Probably less than 6 months.
Even less,
yeah. 4 or 5 months.
Uh-huh.
And over there, we got involved in a continuation of a privy program that we started, sanitation type program that we started.
The cement toilet things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we got the forms, and they would come up with the re-rod and the cement, and then the people would come and mix it, and we would make the thing, and they would make the house and dig the pit.
Mm-hmm.
We went over there and decided to build a rather elaborate privy. And so we put in, and we decided that this was a little bigger town, so we wanted a little privacy over there. So it was part of the... We dug a hole and put the regular sort of squat toilet with the water trap cement type thing.
Uh-huh.
We put that down over that hole. And we built the building long enough so that over in this other part was another hole, except it was not the typical squat toilet. It was simply a diameter hole about 3 or 4 inches, and it had a water trap in it. And that was so we could take a shower. So we had a privy on one side and a shower on the other of this little building that we built.
Uh-huh.
The thing was that we dug these two holes, and then we came over and we had just taken our privy form and just modified it a little bit. So we had these two forms that we brought over and set over these things, and then we poured some more concrete and put this building in. Well, this took 3 or 4 weeks of going over there, working for a few hours, and then coming back at night, this sort of thing. In the meantime, we had the villagers completely stymied as to what those, one has to be male and one has to be female. I mean, that's the only possible explanation, but it didn't make any sense. Of course, we were oblivious to this. It was only later that they began to share with us, after we got to know the people a little bit, these
questions.
First impressions they had of these Americans that had to have two kinds of toilets. So in that area, it was more that was more PR work.
Uh-huh.
They had a much stronger Chau Meng and village leaders. And we didn't have to sell a lot of things. We just worked with their ideas. And again, I was only there for a relatively short time. So we never really got any big projects going other than we worked on that puberty program.
Yeah. And they wanted that?
They did.
Uh-huh.
They did. And that was one of the reasons they, you know, they were concerned about dysentery and some of the diseases they were having and had been convinced, I think through probably their own governmental liaisons.
Mm-hmm.
Health county agents type health nurses, right, this sort of thing, that this was important, and we had we could provide the cement and the forms, and they could dig the holes and put the bamboo shelter over it.
That's good.
So it worked quite well. The only thing that really disappointed me was that I did really work hard to talk the Chau Meng into backing this program.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did know what happened, but the AID person who was responsible for that came up one time, and I don't know what happened, but at the end of, he spent a half a day with him. At the end of the day, the program was flushed, and it was completely abandoned. Now, the day before, this guy was real excited about the program, and I don't know what happened, but I was not very happy about the thing.
No, I'm, from what I'm hearing you say, maybe I'm getting the wrong impression, is that the AID guy might have put pressure on them to switch their priorities.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay,
I'm absolutely sure that that's happened. Why, I don't know.
What did they do instead? Do you have any idea?
We waited about 3 or 4 weeks and went on with the privy program, actually, is what happened.
Oh, really?
We did it anyway.
And the villagers were happy about that.
Well, at least the village leaders. That's what they wanted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the villagers contributed to it. Mm-hmm. But it was getting toward the end of my term anyway, so I didn't know exactly what happened.
I'm just having trouble figuring out the CID stance. Because if they're not coming in with an alternative program, that's even, that might give it some legitimacy.
Let's just say that in the time I was there, there were two individuals with AID who I felt, I'm going to use the word incompetent.
Uh-huh.
And this particular individual was fit that category.
Uh-huh.
Whether it was that it was a program that I developed and wasn't part of his grand scheme that he had turned into here's suddenly this program that he had never mentioned in any preliminary report or what, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I said I had a rather low opinion of the person, so.
Even before?
Yes, definitely before. He had been with us, in fact, he'd been canned, at least that was the word we got. I worked with him early, then he disappeared, someone else came in. The second person then disappeared and he came back, and I don't know the politics of AID.
You don't want to know.
I never want to know at the time. But in the first village I was in, he would come up, and when he came up to visit, he went to one of the leaders of the village and always sat down with him and gave that person a lot of respect. He gave him gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very obvious to anybody in the village that he was held in very high esteem by this American. That American individual never seemed to figure out something we figured out very, very quickly, that this guy was the drug king of the area. That's where he made his money. That's where he had his authority. He was working with a drug dealer, and I don't think he ever knew it.
He
didn't ever really tumble to what was going on. He had drinking problems too, but that's another issue.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, but nevertheless, that I would say was the only, some of the things like I told you about the seeds from Thailand and some of those really, those were honest mistakes or mistakes of ignorance or mistakes of, we got to learn somehow.
Mm-hmm.
That privy program thing was, there was something deliberate about it. and I never understood it. But
yeah, it sounds like simply petty jealousy, if anything.
That was my interpretation, but I was involved in it, so maybe I'm not too objective about the thing, but that's the way I view it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm only saying what I think I'm hearing you say. And for lack of any other input, you know,
For example, when I told you about we had in the first village, we had the main high stilted infirmary, we had this extension out here, and then we had the little one in the village that the local people built.
Yeah.
Well, the first two were part of the original plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw one of his reports where he bragged about the fact that he was instrumental in developing 3 medical facilities. Well, the fact of the matter is he was instrumental in the outlying one.
Mm-hmm.
The big one that was his main thing, well, it finally did get completed, but it was AID finally had to bring in their own contractors and carpenters to do it. The village did. And the other one, the village built all on their own. He had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But it was part of his report. So.
Trying to glom on.
Oh, that's what credits. I thought. That's what I thought.
Yeah. This is interesting. I mean, because this is in your experience on this tape tonight, you've shown me that there were some real variations in the AID programs.
Oh yeah, and I always felt the agricultural ones were pretty solid.
Uh huh.
And the agricultural people that I met, I always had a lot of respect for.
From Delhi to Bangkok to Phnom Penh to Vientiane.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where the people that work in some of the social programs.
Mm-hmm.
I said there were 2 that I felt were incompetent, and I had to work with both of them at one time or another. I'm not a sociologist. Maybe there's something that I missed, but I don't believe that.
No, not when a guy can't figure out who the drug lord is.
Yeah.
That should have been picked up, real, real fast. Yeah, okay. What about IVS as an organization? Was it supportive of you? Did it live up to what you were hoping that it would live up to?
Yeah. I mean, what did they promise me? They promised me 2 years in Southeast Asia.
Well, you yes, know? Okay.
They promised me that I would have some money in the local currency so I could live, I would have some chances to travel, and I would have some American money in the bank when I came back home, and they would pay for a few things for getting my meager possessions to there and back home, and they promised me an opportunity to have some experiences, and the rest was up to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do as much or as little as I wanted. I had the opportunity to be as successful or as innovative as I could within the situation.
Or to fall on your face.
Or to fall on my face, which did a few times, but we won't talk about that. Right.
Well, we all do in that kind of stuff.
I met some very good people.
Mm-hmm.
Not only Cambodians and Laotians, but Americans, IVS people.
Yeah.
And a variety of people. Some of them I had no respect for from the day I met them.
Mm-hmm.
Others, we were talking about some of them, some of the people over dinner tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very high respect even today. None of them ever became close friends or contacts that I see very often or that I write Christmas cards to every year or anything like that. But yet, I've kind of, every once in a while, I kind of follow what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet other IVSers occasionally, and we talk about. But there were a lot of people there who I really admired and respected, and we had some very. There was a lot of good camaraderie among the group. While I would say there were some people I didn't necessarily respect very much as a person. Don't mean to imply in any way we didn't get along.
Yeah.
I don't care for your not you personally, but I didn't care for their lifestyle mm-hmm. and some of the things they chose to do. Mm-hmm. But I could spend an afternoon with them and mm-hmm. and enjoy it very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I spent all the holidays were spent with these friends. Uh-huh. Now, I must admit that Cambodia had some advantage. They had a rather nice marine contingency there with very nice facilities.
Oh, okay.
And so that when it came time for a nice Sunday meal or something, we could go to the Marines ran a restaurant.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And it was cheap.
Uh-huh.
And it was great food.
Huh.
And of course, we're in Southeast Asia, so there's good Chinese restaurants, there's good Laotian, Cambodian restaurants, mm-hmm. good French restaurants. So, there was chances for good food
mm-hmm.
and good companionship.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking also of the job that IVS was able to do in that very unusual political situation with transferring yourself and 23 other people mm-hmm. from, out of Cambodia and very rapid form mm-hmm. and then relocating.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you what kind of marks you would give them for the later placement in Laos, if it pretty much lived up to what you expected them to be able to do.
I guess I never thought they'd do anything different.
Okay.
Until you really mentioned it right now, I mean, we've talked about it. I guess it never has occurred to me to really realize the difficult situation they were in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were immersed in it. It was a daily thing. No big deal.
Yeah.
It wasn't the expected, but but it wasn't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You were expected to handle it, and we did.
Yeah.
No, I guess I never, when I stopped and think about it from that perspective, why they did a marvelous job.
Okay.
But what was marvelous about it, they did it so easily that at the time I just considered it average or normal. what else would they have done?
Well, it strikes me as that too.
Yeah.
But, some people might say, well, they didn't do me right here, they didn't do me right there.
Yeah, I can't say what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I've never heard anything, but I can't say.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say about others, how others might feel who went with me to Laos. But my experience
sounds
was always
very
positive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me pause for just a second, because I'm
making some memories now.
I'm going to turn this back on again.
There were two coups in Laos.
Oh.
Yeah,
he doesn't think of offering those things, never. So,
well, I didn't think of it either, but now that you mention it, hey, I'll take it.
I want some ice cream with my glass of not tea.
Would you like some ice cream, Paul, or something?
Would you like some ice cream? You can have some peaches on it.
Hey, that sounds good.
Would you like that?
That sounds wonderful, too.
Yeah.
We're going to have second feast.
there were two coups.
Uh-huh.
And I was within in 1964, in that calendar year, there were two coups.
Uh-huh.
In both times I was out in the village when they started.
Uh-huh.
Both times I was told, you're not going to go to work today.
Yeah.
That was hard on me.
That work ethic is still there.
That's right. That's right. I was told that I had a radio,
uh-huh.
but I had to run the generator to run the radio,
uh-huh.
Or because otherwise we didn't have any electricity. And the generator was noisy, and I didn't like it. And I called in at noon, as I usually did, and I was told to leave the generator on the radio running.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do that. I mean, that generator was noisy. I wanted to go out and do things. I didn't want to be tied to that thing. Anyway, things quieted down And I usually went into Vincennes every other weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in, the coup was over, I went into town. When I got into town, it turned out that the coup wasn't over.
Uh-huh.
Once I got into town, it started up again.
Oh, okay, so there had been a lull.
There had been a lull. And again, I get the two of them mixed up. They're two different events, but in one of them, I can remember it started in the afternoon. I think this was this one. And I was at the AID office,
mm-hmm.
and the people started firing mortars in town.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one group of mortars here, and the other group of mortars was here, and they're firing back and forth. The AID compound was off to the side, and that was all right, except they weren't very good at firing mortars.
Well, it's not an exact science.
Yeah, and so some of them, even though the guy they were firing at was a mile or so, maybe half a mile away, they were getting very close.
Well, that's not that inaccurate or
big
a science. Yeah.
And one of our IVS guys, who was a little more foolish than some of the others, decided to climb up the water tower and to look around.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there was small arms fire whistling around him. He decided to get out of there. So I sat there, and I'd forgotten that. I sat there really petrified, figuring that, you know, one of those mortars was going to cream us.
It
could very well have. And then there was another lull, and so it was decided that those of us from IBS, and there was quite a few of us at this point, had gotten either because we were working there or accumulated there for one reason or another, decided to go back to our houses. It was a little safer in our housing area than in our than in the compound.
Mm-hmm.
And the housing we had at that time was kind of like very small duplexes, mm-hmm. with driveways in between them. So there was a series, I don't know, five or six of these duplexes.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, there would be a married couple in one, and a couple fellas in another, a couple gals in another, and then two or three of them were just whoever was in town would stay there type thing. And behind it was a long wall that ran around this whole compound, and then the back in there were actually garages,
mm-hmm.
and there were places for washing clothes and storage areas and that sort of thing. And then behind that was a rice paddy that extended 400 or 500 feet. and then the ground rose up again, and then there were houses up in there, but there was this rice paddy between us.
Uh-huh.
So we took our jeeps in, and we set our jeeps in here, and we headed them out, because we were only a half a mile from the river, and if we could get to the river, we could get across the river to Thailand.
Sure, that
so,
makes sense, yeah.
But I can remember sitting there, my friend Henry, I had an apartment, and I was in the temporary one right across the road from him, and there was this driveway was between us, and I was standing there talking to him, and there were tracers coming down the driveway between us, being fired from over in here. It was getting a little touchy, but of course we had no idea what was going on. You know, there's just all this noise.
Yeah.
And it got.
Well, tracers is bad enough.
Yeah. And then, as the night wore on, you know, it gets into early morning now. You know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, you're still
mm-hmm.
up because you're not going to sleep under those conditions.
No.
And there was. It was very quiet, and there had been a moon out for a while, and then the clouds came over, and it became quite dark. And a small single-engine plane could be heard flying around,
uh-huh.
but had no lights on. You
mm-hmm.
could hear it, but you couldn't see it.
Yeah, kind of a little spotter for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there was this kind of this loud noise, and it was some kind of a phosphorescent thing on a parachute coming down. And it lit up the town like it was the middle of the day.
Wow.
One light source, but it was like the sun. And, and it wasn't really that close to us, but it just lit up everything. And that thing was coming down. You could hear the plane circling above you, no lights. Suddenly became aware that all evening, all night long, the dogs had been barking like crazy. It was dead silent.
As soon as that light
source... you could hear the plane, you could kind of hear a sputtering from the flame of this phosphorescent candle or whatever it was.
The dogs just shut right up.
The dogs shut right up. Not a word out of them. Whatever they were after, they were successful, because about 15 minutes later, things were still quiet. We kind of settled down. It was like 2 in the morning. I was like, well, see if we get some shut-eye. The gun had stopped firing. And there was a huge explosion, and the building rocked.
You can put as much peaches on as you want.
They had, one group had dropped a mortar on the ammo dump of the other group.
Aha.
And so it was noisy for a long, long time that night that ammo dump burned.
And continued to set off
and
charges.
And continued to set off all kinds of things.
Oh, my
God. Now, that thing was 8 or 10 miles away, but that was a noisy night.
Oh, man.
And when we went out the next morning, there was a dead body in that rice field.
I was wondering, first of all, how long did you stay until when in 65? When was the last?
June.
It was a full two years
from the I probably to the day, from the day that I arrived in Washington for orientation, was probably 2 years. That day later, I left.
Okay, I didn't know of switching countries and all of the confusion there might have caused some.
In this case, it did not.
Okay.
I made a 2-year commitment. At the end of that 2 years, my commitment was up, and I was then ready to move on to the next phase of my life. And
did you feel satisfied with your results of your commitment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, as we were talking earlier, I don't know how much got on tape and how much we talked about at lunch, but over the meal, but I left Cornell because I didn't know the direction I wanted to go.
Right.
And so that was a period of me finding myself much as anything else. And it served that purpose. It took the full 2 years. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready to do it after a few months.
Right.
But I came back then full of goals. And by the time I came back, I had been accepted into graduate school. I had a new teaching appointment at Michigan State to finish my PhD.
And didn't take any tangents, went straight to the soil science?
Went straight to the soil science, taught. This has nothing to do with IBS, but there was a new teaching method called the audio tutorial method, which you've never heard of. But it was developed by a man named Postaway in about 60 at Purdue. And when I went to Michigan State, Hank Foth, who was to be my major professor, and I was to teach under him, taught the introductory soils course, and he was interested in this method. So I visited Postaway and several other places with him. For a year, we talked about it. For a year, we developed it. For a year, we carried it out.
Yeah.
That was the end of my 3 years. I had my degree. There's a lot of history behind it, but the bottom line was that at the end of that 3 years, it turned out that Iowa State had made a commitment to the audio tutorial concept in their crops course and had been very successful at it. They now were making a commitment to do it in their soils course. The only difference was when they decided to do it for crops, there was a professor willing to take it on. In the soils group, everybody agreed it was a good idea, but none of them wanted to do it.
And so, there you were.
So they created a position. They wanted somebody to use the auditorial method to teach soils.
Mm-hmm.
It was only being taught at one other place in the world. And the person who was teaching it was a graduate of Iowa State, and he had only one graduate student who was available at that time, and that was me.
Guess who?
So, I've been here ever since. Doing primarily undergraduate teaching in soils, which is what you wanted to do.
What
I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a good life.
Yeah, no. It's
not only that, but Iowa State has had a what they call the Ag Travel Course.
Mm-hmm.
It began in the 30s. A 6-credit course, 3 credits in animal science, 3 in agronomy, 6 weeks on the road.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I came here is because I felt that was a neat thing.
Mm-hmm.
For undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a group in the early 70s to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I took a group to Europe. A few years later, I took another one to the U.S. I was fortunate enough to lead the first ag travel course and the first group of American ag students to go into China since before the 30s or something
mm-hmm.
like that. I was to China 3 times in the early 70s, and then going into areas where no American had been since the 30s, and each time different places. I taught for a semester,
mm-hmm.
for about a month at a university at one time. Grace went with me. We spent.
Mm-hmm.
Point being, I've been, my interest in travel is, and I took a group to Russia. Another time, so I've been to Africa on a couple occasions and Europe
oh.
several occasions. In fact, Grace and I just got back in this June from Eastern Europe, and it's the 5th trip that we've made to Eastern Europe in the last 6 years. So,
ooh.
The point being that the international flavor that began with IVS has continued and has been a very important part of my life. And always at the village level.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Africa one time, and the only contact I had in Western Africa was my cousin, who was a Catholic priest missionary. Lots of people go to Tanzania or to Kenya or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent several nights in a mud hut in a Maasai village, you know. Others stayed at the Hilton in Nairobi or something. But again, because of, if I hadn't have been with IVS, I would have never had the interest or the courage to do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's now been out of print for several years, but I am co-author of a book on the soils of the world.
Really?
Mm-hmm. With Hank Foth, my major professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught a course on world soils here for many years before I moved on to other things. But
mm-hmm.
but that whole idea, and you talked earlier about pictures of my experience. So everything I did was with slides, and the slides are at the university because I use them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
My students.
Mm-hmm.
Go all over the world in my classes because I take them there. When we talk about various crops, and we don't just talk about corn and soybeans in Iowa, or maybe we'll talk about peanuts in Georgia, but we talk about
and other
yams,
foreign
we
places.
Talk about yams and cassava and rice and my students, by the time they're done, even in my beginning soils course, which is not intended in any way to be a world type thing, but we do talk about soils of the world and different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a great thing. I don't know, I've lost track of how many times I've been across the Atlantic or the Pacific. I'm sure there are lots of others who have traveled a lot more than I have, but yet I've certainly done a whole lot more than average.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and I like the what you're saying about the integration of your slides into a course, because it would be so easy to do that
kind of a course simply talking in clinical language without showing people and plants and the relationship of different cultures to the soil and the plants that grow in that particular
kind of soil. It always amazed me when I got back and started, okay, now I'm going to talk about this, and then, I've got a slide that'll illustrate that. I didn't take the slide for that purpose. But, you know, we'll talk about weeds and weed control in the tropics in an area where they don't have frost and stuff to kill them off in the winter and and this sort of thing. And I've got some beautiful pictures. You know, I've got a picture of something that looks like just a big field of weeds. And then they're close up, it's a field of melons. But they could not keep ahead of the weeds. And so they finally decided, with this hand labor that they had, that maybe they could go around each plant and just weed it back to give it, you know,
just a little bit.
Maybe 14 inches of. Then the insects found it. So here's this beautiful melon plant. No weeds within 8 inches in any direction. But those leaves are just riddled by insect damage. Well, these make good stories. You talk about climatic effects, you talk about soils and soil properties, and so, you know, I've used them. I talk by name, talk about Cambodia and Laos and and all of these other areas. So, you know, it has a very lasting influence on me. In the end, with what happened in Cambodia and to a lesser extent in Laos and that part of the world. And I don't know that I left any significant mark or impact on anything or anybody. But it sure left an impact on me. And then through my teaching, a small impact, at least on some of the students who remember what I said.
Yeah, we sometimes wonder.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. You just made a brief in-out mention, but you're saying you don't know how much of an impact you made, but it certainly made an impact on you. If I change the words around, that you got more out of the experience than you might have wanted to have given in the first place. Now, let me try it again. I know that when I went into Peace Corps, I wanted to do all this service stuff. I look back and I got so much, and I wonder how much I was able to give in exchange. Would that be true for you, too?
Exactly. It can't have been very much.
Well, whatever it was.
At least in the
measure came back greater to me than I was able in any way to give.
But particularly,
even with working my rear end off.
Yeah. But particularly when, you know, when you realize what kind of genocide that went on in Cambodia and the disruption of that whole society, of a whole generation or two, maybe, I don't know, by the time they're done, or more, the probability that I had any impact of at all is pretty small. But I didn't go over there to bring glory to myself necessarily either, or to change the world. I was not quite that naive. But you get a lot more than you ever give out of those sorts of things. And,
I'm just interested that you threw this in, not using the exact words that I did, but the same idea. And the words that I was trying to grasp for were closer to what many other people have all said. That almost everyone says that they themselves got so much out of it, and some people, if they have regrets, it's that they might not have been able to give as much as they received. But
In retrospect, I think when you look at the age of the people who do this, what are we really capable of doing, most of us, at that point in our lives? You know, I said earlier, I was going in search of something, and what I was searching for was inside me, and I knew that when I went. But, you know, what did I have? I didn't have enough of life experiences. I was too naive. All of the things that I've learned today over the years might have made me more effective then. But I wouldn't go now. I went then.
That's right.
You know, so, yeah. So
we're not talking about now, we're talking about
we're
then.
We're talking about then. We're talking about then.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no regrets about anything I guess I've ever done in life. Well, you know. Sometimes you were nasty to somebody.
Oh, yeah, right.
That kind of stuff.
But, no, I remember one thing I said to an aunt of mine that it still makes me feel bad.
Yeah,
but, you
but,
know.
Yeah.
But she's probably long forgotten.
Yeah.
No, let me get back to, we're almost in wrap-up sort of questions, but getting back to some of the experience, I did have a few things. One of the best known people that was ever in IVS was that fellow Pop Buell, who was up in Laos. Did you ever have an occasion where you met the man?
He was gone by the time I got there.
He was?
As far as I know, he was.
Oh.
Well, maybe I should rephrase that. He was gone from IVS.
He was gone from IVS, yes.
He may have still been there. I can't say. I never met him.
Okay. All right. Okay. Because some volunteers had met him. On one occasion or the some volunteers, few, worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
Either when they were, very, very few when they were with IVS, but some later when they were with AID. So I was wondering.
Now obviously he was long gone, but I was once involved in a situation where I wasn't directly involved in it, but some IVSers dug up an old burial site where Tom Dooley had buried some of his medical stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
You know, the bloody bandages and stuff you got to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And he had buried some stuff not too far from
just medical garbage.
Just medical garbage, but
yeah.
But not too far from where I was stationed.
Mm-hmm.
So that again, he was dead by the time that. That I got there, but that had, I read most of his works while I was in Laos, and that had
mm-hmm.
a lot of meaning to me too, because he described the people and his reactions to them, and I could see,
mm-hmm.
I could look out my window and see what he's talking about, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Had you read any of Tom Dooley's things before you went
no,
there? Okay,
I'm not.
So it was only during that time.
Yeah,
because it was interesting. Some people that I had spoken to. I guess fairly early on in this interview process, had mentioned that reading, I forget some of the titles of the book, The Night They Burned the Mountain,
mm-hmm.
or something like that, was one of the titles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I read them, I remember, as high school, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the influences on mm-hmm. them to join IVS.
Right.
So that's interesting. Well, I hadn't really intended to ask about Tom Dooley, but there was a fellow by the name of Buell who worked up with the Hmong people,
mm-hmm.
or the Mao people. That's who I was
mm-hmm.
thinking of.
Yeah, no, I know who you meant.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
I wasn't confusing, I was just adding
another
issue to it. Yeah.
Then I thought you might have been,
no.
I was thinking, how did I give that impression?
No,
yeah,
no,
but,
no.
Okay. Alrighty. I had another question in mind that I'd been thinking about. Well, yeah, just generally in your Laos experience, I mean, it wasn't a full 2 years, it was about a year and a half there. Had you noticed, other than the coups, which are internal in
mm-hmm.
Vientiane politics and all that, but out in the countryside, any deterioration in the political military situation?
No, quite the opposite.
An improvement.
An improvement.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I first came, I said this. I think the soldiers were more afraid than we were, and maybe they were smarter than we were. But
that was when they moved.
Yeah, let them move back. But that was when I first came, and you know, then later on, we went into areas with our counterparts. In fact, you know, we had
extension agent counterparts.
We, they were with us swimming the day that Patalao went by.
Uh-huh.
So I think that they improved, and
Were your counterparts terrified?
I don't think so.
Really?
They may have been scared, but not.
They didn't show it.
Yeah, okay. They didn't show it to the extent that I remembered it all.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. When we went, I can't remember the name of that second village. Anyway, when we went to that second village, they had what they call a rocket festival each year.
Uh-huh, I've heard of them.
And in fact, we paid somebody to build an IVS rocket that year.
Mm-hmm.
And we must have paid them well because it went the highest of all the rockets in the festival.
Oh, my.
So, for that festival, a couple generals from the military.
Our military?
No.
Laotian
military. Okay. Who were from that area.
Mm-hmm.
Came to participate in that rocket festival.
Uh-huh.
And the next day they led a tremendous military invasion of some regions rather nearby. They had used that festival as a cover to get the generals up there.
Uh-huh.
So that they cleared out an area, and within a few weeks we helicoptered in. We meaning a couple IVS people, a couple AID people, and we brought in school books in Laotian language and pencils and, and some rice and stuff into some of those areas. So I got back into some areas that were rather remote.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because they had cleared that out. So I think things were, really when I left in 65, I thought things were really moving quite nicely.
Hmm, okay.
They turned around after that, but
yeah, I'm just trying to figure out the waxing and waning of war and mm-hmm. how that happened to be. The only thing I can think of.
And that was my part. That was my experience in the southern part, or in the central part of the country.
Yeah, it might have been
north
different.
In the north or the south, it may have been quite different, but that was my impression in the area I was in.
Oh, yeah, we can only speak to what we know.
Yeah. We had IVS people in the south, we had IVS people in the north, and I didn't have a lot of, I knew who they were, and we talked, when we met, we were social, but
mm-hmm.
I really didn't know much about their programs, and they didn't know much about mine.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just curious about this. It could be speculation, so I'm going to pause this. We're back on again.
Yeah.
And I was ruminating about the greater war situation, and you were just commenting how you'd read things in the national press or international press if it's Time and Newsweek, and they weren't well informed, and a lot of people didn't know. But there was bombing up to the north in Laos. Did you hear any of that, or any news of activities in the northern part of the country, the Plain of Jars and such?
The Plain of Jars stuff had occurred,
mm-hmm.
as I recall.
Uh-huh.
So I knew of that event.
Yeah.
But these were still, I think, considered isolated incursions.
Mm-hmm.
The degree of commitment of U.S. military in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Was not really public knowledge. They didn't brag about the military didn't brag about it, and I don't think the press bothered to send anybody in that part of the world to even look at that early mm-hmm. stages.
Yeah, or so, may not have picked up enough to send somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course that's a difficult part of the world to travel in.
Oh yeah.
So you don't just take somebody from Brooklyn and send them out to the Plain of Jars to find out what's going on there. You got to find somebody who's familiar enough with the territory they can survive.
Mm-hmm.
I knew things were going on. Mm-hmm. Things were heating up.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I was in Da Nang twice in early '64 and then, or mid '64 maybe,
And then maybe very early 65, something. And I could see that a definite change had taken place.
But that's in South Vietnam.
That's right, but that's all I could see.
Yeah.
And what I could see was U.S.
Mm-hmm.
activity there.
In Da Nang.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as northern Laos, you would just hear of things, but not really know anything.
Didn't really know anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Others may have known more, but I didn't.
Okay. No, I was just curious as to... I asked that because we wanted to see, you know, how much news traveled. I mean, mm-hmm. Laos is a very, as you just said, it's very difficult to travel. Mm-hmm. And anytime you get rugged terrain, you find a great variation in cultures. And that certainly Laos.
Oh, yes. Yes. You know,
the next hill is a completely different mm-hmm. culture because that
yep.
that hill is more of a mountain and completely right. cuts them off.
It's a barrier.
Yeah, it really is. And the river system doesn't promote that mm-hmm. kind of cross-cultural
yeah.
travel that would homogenize people. Mm-hmm. So it's very likely that people could live in one part of Laos and have absolutely no idea what was going on somewhere else.
Yeah, and when you look at Laos, you know, it's a pretty long country, north to south.
It is.
So as poor as travel and communication is, when you get that distance to go over, it wasn't very wide east and west, but it's long
yeah, right.
as Vietnam is.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're just checking through some of those things. I think we've gone through a lot. Is there anything that I might have asked that you could think of that you would have?
No.
Okay. All right. Sometimes the best question is to say, what did I miss?
Yeah.
And then get some information.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, we're coming close, not real close, but somewhat close mm-hmm. to the end of this second tape. Two tapes.
Okay.
And so I'd like to say thank you. For your hospitality. It's good meeting you and Grace both.
It's rare to find somebody who's willing to listen to your stories. My closest friends have heard all they want to hear, and the young people don't know what I'm talking about. So.
Right, no, the young people don't know, and I think everybody, when they come home, I've had the experience of trying to talk to people and only being at best able to gain people's attention for about 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
before, you know, nothing connects with them and they just desperately look to change the topic on you.
Well, I guess that's the one advantage of living in a college town like this. I went to China for the first time in 79,
mm-hmm.
so it's very early, and nobody.
Actually, I think I'll just turn this off
here. Yeah, do that.
Because we're just going to chit-chat right now. So, goodbye.